I call this meeting of the House Preventive Health Division to order. The first item on the agenda is the roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Freiberg.
Present.
Freiberg present. Vice Chair Bierman.
Bierman present.
Bierman present. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen present.
Grunhagen present. Representative Akam.
Present.
Akam present. Representative Abaje.
Present.
Abaje present. Representative Ackland.
Present.
Ackland present. Representative Carlson.
Present.
Carlson present. Representative Franzen.
Present.
Franzen present. Representative Heinzman.
Present.
Heinzman present. Representative Morrison.
Morrison present.
Morrison present. And Representative Pryor.
Present.
Pryor present. Chair, you have a quorum.
Quorum is present. The next item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes of the March 16th meeting. Representative Bierman, would you like to move approval of the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the approval of the March 16th meeting, please.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bierman has moved approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion or corrections? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the minutes are adopted. So we have a couple presentations on end-of-life planning and hospice care to begin the hearing today, and then we will hear one of Representative Morrison's bills on an informational basis. So first, we will hear from Dr. Robert Moravec. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Moravec. Please just identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your presentation.
Thank you very much. I'm Dr. Robert Moravec. I'm a board certified emergency physician in St. Paul. I practice at St. Joseph's Hospital in St. Paul. I was the medical director of the hospital, and important to this discussion, I was the chair of the St. Joseph's Hospital Ethics Committee for my duration as a hospital medical director. I'm here to testify in support of this bill. And I just want you to realize that advanced care planning does not necessarily make a difference in the overall cost of care, which I'll get to in a second, but it has some outcomes that you might be looking for. As we talk about advanced care planning, the key ethical principles between physicians and patients are the principle of beneficence, which means to bring benefit to the patient, the principle of non-maleficence, which means do not provide harm to the patient, and importantly, the principle of autonomy, which means the ability of a patient to make decisions for themselves. Near the end of life care, challenges come as one loses the capacity to make decisions, to understand their choices, the options of those medical treatments, and importantly, the consequences of those decisions. And so advanced care planning, as we're talking about here, is the mechanism to document one's preferences, beliefs, values, and provide a method of shared decision-making between a patient and their physician. The concept of shared decision-making between a patient and a physician can happen in a couple ways. One is certainly the patient maintains full capacity to participate in decisions, to evaluate the choices made before them, to make decisions, and to understand the consequences. But in many cases, the patient's not able to speak for themselves. And so advanced care planning and decision-making, shared decision-making can happen through a proxy that's on behalf of the patient to speak for them, especially if they lack capacity. This can happen in a couple ways. One would be a durable medical power of attorney. The second way is what we often term is a living will or advanced directive document. And in this advanced directive document, it may contain a named proxy or decision maker in the event of incapacity, such as through a stroke or dementia or trauma. And or it may contain instructions and preferences of the patient and beliefs to help guide decisions. But we have to remember that this document, anything that's written down, has to be interpreted in the context of each medical situation. There's no way that one can predict all the various circumstances regarding medical care. And we do know that the number of choices for a patient start to narrow considerably as we approach the end of life. Often, we get to the final choice of yes or no resuscitation or no resuscitation. But there are many decisions along the way regarding dialysis, feeding tubes, ventilators care, antibiotics and other supportive IV fluids, et cetera, that come way before this end of life final decision. And so advanced care planning really does support our awareness and knowledge of what the patient's desires are. My understanding of House File 2670 was that it would add advanced care planning as a covered benefit for medical assistance plans. In Minnesota, the main program to bring advanced care planning to patients was through the Honoring Choices Minnesota program. And this was developed and supported by the Twin City Medical Society and its foundation. But Honoring Choices was based on a similar program in La Crosse, Wisconsin, where two major health systems implemented a collaborative, systematic, and community-wide advanced directive advanced care planning program called Respecting Your Choices. And that Respecting Choices provided education materials, trained facilitators, access to those educators and materials, and very importantly, documentation in the healthcare record of the education and advanced care planning. The key study of Respecting Choices was published in the American Medical Association Journal in 1998. And this study reviewed all deaths within the five zip codes in La Crosse County of people who had the capacity to make the decisions in the 10 years prior to their death. And in looking at those deaths, documenting the frequency that advanced care planning was either documented in the medical record and followed. So prior to implementing Respecting Choices, only 15% of the community residents had advanced care planning documents. After the program was implemented with the assistance of the Franciscan Health System and the Gunderson Health System down there, 95% of the community had advanced care planning documents. 85% of the decedents qualifying for the study had advanced care planning completed. And 98% of the care was in concordance with the advanced care planning documents. So Honoring Choices was developed in Minnesota to be similar but broader. It was a statewide program with the support of most major health systems, health plans, and medical professional associations. It also trained volunteers as facilitators. It developed advanced care planning forms and documents. And it partnered with Twin City Public Television for the public education about the importance of ACP discussions with family and friends. But Honoring Choices also recognized the inequities of access to its programs, access to, in various cultural communities and geographies, and especially for those patients that had no connection to healthcare providers. I would say do not pass this bill with an expectation of reductions in overall healthcare costs. There are good systematic reviews that show little association between advanced care planning and overall healthcare cost and healthcare use. The patients that are involved with advanced care planning, though, have had significant discussions with their families and with their friends and their doctors. Advanced care planning enhances this discussion about the realities of the end of life care. It assists families with care conferences earlier in the course of serious illness. It encourages discussions with physicians about the goals of care upon admission to a hospital or nursing home. And it helps establish time-specific goals about interventions, procedures, and life-sustaining measures. In a busy physician's office or clinic visit, whether this is a preventive care visit or a follow-up of an established medical problem, advanced care planning discussions rarely happen. For instance, in a study just presented in December 2021 at the American Society of Hematology out of Massachusetts General Hospital, they documented that over a quarter of advanced planning discussions occurred either in the ED, emergency department, or in the ICU instead of in the primary care office. And only 60% of patients were able to participate in their final care decisions because of incapacity. So even with these series of patients with lymphoma and leukemia, only 8% of those patients had any restrictions on life-sustaining therapies. Then the study underscored how late in the course of illness these discussions occur and how rushed families and friends feel making these challenging decisions at the end of life. I ask you to pass this bill in support of those patients with limited access to their healthcare clinic, either through geography or through cultural barriers. It would assist clinics in providing resources and materials. It would give physicians incentive during their visits with patients to open the discussion and encourage questions about goals of treatments, about expectations of interventions, and documentation of those discussions and decisions. The outcome of this enhanced coverage can be expected to result in increased family participation and comfort with end-of-life care decisions, ease the guilty feelings by family and friends in that they know they are following patients' wishes, and help healthcare providers know that they are, in fact, following the patient's autonomous wishes at the end of life. I'm open to any questions, Chairman, and I'll stop there.
Thank you, Dr. Moravec. And just so members are aware, Representative Morrison will be giving a presentation of her bill, House File 2670, which we'll discuss on an informational basis. Dr. Morrison referenced that bill a bit in his testimony. This would be probably a better time for general questions about advanced care planning, but there will be also an opportunity for questions about Representative Morrison's bill after she has presented it. Members, Representative Pryor, I see you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as a general question about some of the material that Dr. Moravec has just covered. So you made a great description of what this is all about and all the aspects of it. Also, especially the work that's been done, and you cite what's been done in the La Crosse area and how that really has been comprehensive. So what kind of outcomes did they document as a result of having done all that work? So I know it was comprehensive. So many people did participate in end-of-life planning, but then, what benefit does that give the individuals, the people that, the descendants of those people and the community at large, that all of that work had been done for end-of-life planning?
And you're talking about—
Dr. Moravec.
So I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. The legislative process generally, speak through the chair. So just recognizing you here, it does get a little awkward though, especially over Zoom.
Yeah.
So proceed, Dr. Moravec.
I assume you're talking about the La Crosse study.
Right.
And so as a fairly long study that surveyed the physicians, the proxies that participated in end of life care, and it really did document, though, that the comfort that families and friends had in those decisions because of the advanced care directive. But it also underscored that there was still no way to demonstrate reductions in healthcare costs. In fact, the study wasn't designed for that. But it did show that a community-wide effort, a formal program, can have a benefit through allowing physicians to follow those advanced care directives. If 98% of goal concordant care was followed, that's pretty significant for those patients and families. Not all advanced care directives ask for CPR to not be administered or ask for termination of life-sustaining therapies. Many of them, in fact, want full support, want to maintain all medical supports until the end of life. And so I think the study really did show goal concordance with advanced care planning. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answered your question or not. I referenced the studies that showed a lack of savings with advanced care planning. I didn't reference those, but I can certainly provide those references to the committee chair if need be to forward on to the rest of the committee members. Mm-hmm. Many of these studies are reviews of articles. In some case, let me pull them up here. I probably have them right at hand here. And There we go. So in 2018, there were 80 systematic reviews of 1,600 articles that showed no evidence that advanced care planning was influenced the cost of care at the end of life. And other studies that showed no link between goal concordant care and advanced care planning. So really the benefit of this, I think, comes from encouraging the discussions, comfort level at the end of life. We know that towards the end of life, we're all probably going to, you know, go through those procedures to actually demonstrate that we have no further choices. That may mean a ventilator for a short period of time. That may mean a feeding tube or some type of nutritional support and IV fluids near the end of life. That may mean dialysis and other type of care, only to get to the point where it's starting to be futile. To separate out those patients that are going to recover for because of that time-limited treatment and those patients for which these interventions are futile. It's those patients that are futile towards the end of life where advanced care planning does have the benefit, especially with the friends and families that might have to make that decision on behalf of a patient. And on the ethics committee that I chaired at St. Joe's, I could feel the comfort from those family and friends that had had those discussions with their patient. And I also saw many times where the lack of advanced care planning documents really brought out differences in the family. You have one son saying do everything, and you have one daughter saying do nothing because she wouldn't want it. And you have this push and pull. In families, the aftermath of that is significant for families that did not have advanced care planning documentation.
Thank you, Dr. Moravec.
Yep.
Representative Pryor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Moravec, for that was the question that I was asking. And it's good to understand that we're not looking for savings in healthcare, but what we're really doing by bringing forward this discussion is better healthcare. So that the provider knows that they're in sync with the patient, and then is doing the right thing for the family too, having discussed these things ahead of time and being that trusted care provider. So appreciate your answer and the discussion.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask a couple questions of Mr. Moravec. Thank you for the presentation. Really good information. I appreciate your work and study in this area. And I think you bring out the fundamental issues that, you know, we really do need to work on. End of care issues of the beneficence you mentioned and the autonomy. It's as you just said, it's a fact that, you know, when those decisions aren't made ahead of time, when people don't know, it really becomes a tug of war sometimes between family members. I've seen that up close. And to have that known what the patient wants, it just settles things down and makes people understand. And it is about the patient and the autonomy they seek. So I appreciated the earlier information about Wisconsin. But the question is, do you know, are there any providers in Minnesota that you're aware of that have a standard practice in this area now?
Dr. Moravec.
I do not. I think probably the group of palliative care providers as a specialty, hospice care providers, I think have the training and have the awareness as a person approaches end of life and seeks palliation from their symptoms. Just the one thing to remember is that those two specialties are different. Palliative care and hospice care are two different specialties in medicine. So hospice to helping assist towards the end of life. But palliative care is more the manage of serious symptoms and significant symptoms. May not even be associated with end of life care, but those two specialties, I think, have that as a general practice. Intensive care physicians probably do, but I don't think it's very much the standard of their practice.
Thank you. And we are hearing next from the network of hospice and palliative care, so we can go into more detail on that.
Very good.
Continue, Representative Bierman.
one more question. I just wondered, you mentioned Wisconsin. Are you aware of any other regions or states that have had such a bill that has made the impacts you described in the Wisconsin area?
I am.
Dr. Moravec.
Yep, sorry. I am not, no. Honoring Choices Minnesota did have offers and helped other states assist other states in getting the program going. And I think maybe even internationally, I recall something, they may even have helped started this in Australia, but no other local regional programs that I'm aware of, you know, were as broad as Honoring Choices.
Representative, okay. Mr. Chair, just one more question. The question on an advanced care directive, I just wonder, does that have any, you know, are there times where it might expire, or does this have to be renewed, as far as you know? I'm just wondering.
Dr. Moravec.
No, it does not. So the documents in Minnesota do require two witnesses to just to witness that the patient's signature is made at a time when they have capacity. It does not require a notary, and it does not require a lawyer. But it is, and once it's written and completed, it is a valid document until it's either destroyed or replaced by a newer document. The challenges are having it available. It's often not in the medical record. It's sitting in on people's desk. It's sitting in their, you know, in their safe somewhere. It could be, you know, it might be sitting in a medical files and their of their other paperwork in their home. Having it in the thing in La Crosse showed that having it available in the medical record is what is brings that information to physicians. And in my current position, I travel around the country evaluating hospitals and healthcare systems as a Joint Commission surveyor, and I look at records all over the country. The best records are those that have an advanced care document that pops up at the top of the header screen for a patient. So no matter when a physician is looking at the medical record, there's either a flashing bar or flashing light or something that says this person has an ACP document. Not all systems have that. Those that do follow it and have access to it immediately, whether you're an ED doctor, an IC doctor, or a family practitioner in the clinic.
Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Chair, just one more quick question. The question is, so just to be clear, this is all just voluntary. The patient decides if they want it or not, and it is, there's no mandate that patients have to fill one out, correct?
Dr. Moravec.
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Moravec.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Moravec, I'm hearing a reference, and I'm seeing in our materials today for the committee, a group, and you mentioned them, compassion and choices. And as I am looking to see kind of what is in the internet world on all this, I see a number of organizations. I see Honoring Choices, and I see Respecting Choices, and there's a whole number of organizations that apparently are nationwide and working, I'm assuming, somewhat collaboratively, but maybe that's not the case. Could you let me know if that's how these groups are connected, or if their efforts are connected? Just trying to better understand kind of how this is happening around the country.
Dr. Moravec.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish I could give you a thorough review of that. I'm not aware of, you know, of strong associations. Maybe other testifiers might be. I know that I think it's the is it the Association for Aging or a similar organization does have also some advanced care planning documents. But yeah, the ones you're referencing, I'm not aware of direct connections between them, but they all probably support a similar cause of supporting patients' families near the end of life.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Dr. Moravec, just so an honoring choices, I just Googled them as well. They're, it looks like they're an initiative of the Twin Cities Medical Society. Is that correct?
Yes. Yep. Actually, it started as the Twin Cities Medical Society Foundation, supported by the Twin Cities Medical Society. It is, to be honest, right now, it is, as of December 31st, basically gone on a pause for lack of funding. It was supported by the major healthcare plans and hospitals through grants, through non-profit grants. There was some legislative support in the past years, which could not occur in the past 2 years, I think primarily because of COVID and expenses and costs related to that. But all the documents, all the materials are still available for patients.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at some of the same things, Mr. Chair, but then I also saw, I'm looking at the exact same page you are, that this organization, Honoring Choices, serves as a convener of a national network of independent Honoring Choices groups. And I can't see too much more beyond that, but I just am wondering, you know, how all of that may or may not be connected. And clearly there is some kind of national movement, I guess, and discussion is connected, but wanted to just ask, and I appreciate the answer, although it sounds as though there's maybe some more here that we could look at as we look at the language of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Heintzman. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I got a question for Dr. Moravec. You know, I think the vast majority of people would support, I certainly do, end-of-life planning. The concern that comes up is that there's a lot of organizations connected with this that want to legalize doctor-assisted suicide, which we even have a Minnesota statute against that. It's section 609.2.15. which you're probably familiar with. So, you know, medically assisted suicide is legal in, according to my research, in 11 states so far, certain jurisdictions, I don't know if it's statewide. And I have a number of concerns about that, as other people do. You know, I don't want to keep people alive artificially that should pass away. But on the other hand, I don't want to support efforts to terminate and kill people before their time. And so my question to you, Dr. Moravec, is, are you connected with any of these organizations that want to legalize assisted suicide?
Thank you. I mean, just before Dr. Moravec answers this, so we're clear, I mean, we are talking about advanced care planning. Certainly, there are organizations that support medical aid in dying that are out there as well, and they also support advanced care planning, but those are two distinct issues, but and we're not talking about medical aid in dying in this hearing, but I'll allow a little leeway here, but I don't want to go too far into this discussion. So, Dr. Moravec.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, in the question about an association with those organizations that are promoting physician aid in dying or assisted suicide, to my knowledge, there is no association between Honoring Choices and those organizations. Advanced care planning isn't necessarily at all supportive of physician-assisted suicide or physician aid in dying. I think it's more a method to document the autonomous wishes of a patient, which has to be interpreted in the medical context that they find themselves in. And the proxy's job is to help interpret that at a time when the patient doesn't have capacity to even express their own wishes. So.
Okay, thank you. Representative Grunhagen? Follow up, or are you?
Yeah, just thank you for that response, Dr. Morvick. Appreciate the opportunity just to ask that.
Thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. I don't see any additional member questions. So Dr. Morvick, if you're available, we're going to get a presentation from the network of hospice and palliative care next, and then we will discuss the bill you referenced. So it's possible questions may come up. So if you're able to stick around for the bill discussion, that'd be great, but certainly no obligation if you have other places to go as well. So next we have Jessica Hausauer from the Minnesota Network of Hospice and Palliative Care to give a presentation on those topics. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hausauer. Please identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Great, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Hausauer and I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Network of Hospice and Palliative Care. We're the state association for hospice and palliative care providers across Minnesota and the surrounding region. Today, I'm gonna define palliative care and hospice. I'm gonna share some data about hospice in Minnesota and then provide some suggestions for how we can improve end-of-life care in our state. So to get us started here, palliative care is simply medical care for people living with serious illness. It focuses on improving quality of life by reducing pain, symptoms, and stress related to serious illness. Importantly, palliative care supports both patients and their caregivers. Palliative care can be received at any age and any stage of a serious illness. So that means as soon as you receive that cancer diagnosis or that diabetes diagnosis, palliative care is appropriate right from the beginning. Palliative care, you can receive treatments intended to cure while receiving palliative care as well. This care is provided by a team, an interdisciplinary team that does collaborate with your primary care doctor or other specialists. And it can be received almost anywhere. It can be received in your home, in a hospital, outpatient clinic. Those are some examples. Medicare Part B and Medicaid, as well as some private insurance plans, provide some coverage for palliative care, but generally reimbursement is somewhat lacking for palliative care programs. So what is hospice? Hospice is palliative care.
Ms. Hausauer, I'm not sure we're seeing your slides. Are your slides advancing?
They are on my screen.
Okay, you might be showing, you might be sharing the wrong screen. We're just seeing the first slide.
Oh, okay. Let me try again.
There you go.
Is that working?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So speaking of hospice, hospice is palliative care that is specific to the final 6 months of life. So it's really specific to that end of life period. In order to receive hospice, you do have to forego curative treatment. And the primary payer for hospice is Medicare. So there's a specific Medicare hospice benefit that pays for hospice. Just like palliative care, hospice reduces the physical, spiritual, social, and emotional pain associated with serious illness. And importantly, hospice provides significant grief support to the family of the hospice patient up to 13 months after their loved one dies. And are my slides advancing, Mr. Chair?
Yes, they are now. Thank
you. Okay, great. Thank you. So hospice is a service, not a setting. So that means that hospice, again, just like palliative care, can be received wherever you call home. So it can be received in your private residence, in an assisted living center, long-term care facility, hospital. Some examples here are on the screen. So again, who pays for hospice? The primary payer is Medicare. There is coverage through medical assistance, Minnesota Care. Most private insurance companies cover hospice. Some people will do private pay, and then there is veterans hospice benefits as well. This chart sort of sums up the core differences between palliative care. This is a really basic kind of nuts and bolts description here. So palliative care is appropriate for folks with serious illness. Hospice is appropriate for terminal illness. Palliative care is not time limited. Hospice is appropriate for folks who have 6 months or less to live. You can receive curative treatment while receiving palliative care, but you do not receive curative treatment while receiving hospice. There is not a Medicare-defined benefit for palliative care in the same way that there is a Medicare benefit for hospice. Research shows many benefits of palliative care and hospice. So research shows that the pain and symptoms are much better managed for folks on hospice and palliative care. Patients and families report higher quality of life. Some studies actually show when connected to palliative care early on in the disease trajectory, it can lengthen life for folks with serious illness. Families report greater satisfaction. Bereavement outcomes are improved. Physician satisfaction is higher. Patients generally will see fewer ER visits and fewer hospital stays, fewer unwanted medical interventions, and spend less time in the hospital and are less likely to die in the hospital. So hospice in Minnesota, one of the key data points that we look at is hospice utilization, which is a measure of Medicare hospice deaths divided by total Medicare deaths. You can see here kind of the trajectory for over the, from 2016 to 2020. We're seeing increasing utilization in Minnesota. In 2016, 48.7% of Medicare beneficiaries who died were using the hospice benefit. In 2020, that rose up to 53.6%. In 2016, we were ranked 15th overall in the nation in terms of hospice utilization, and in 2020, we were ranked 8th. The general trend nationally is similar. We are seeing increased hospice utilization across the country. This graphic here is using data from 2017, so it's a little bit dated, but it gives some good data points for us to consider. So one I would point out is that in the first column here on the left, in 2017, we had 25,690 Medicare hospice patients. If you consider that hospice cares for the family and provides that grief support, we serve well over 50,000 patients per year in Minnesota, which gives us a broad reach of care. In the middle column here, I'll point out the hospice days. We have 27 days as the median, 67 as the mean. What I would point out here is that you'll recall hospice, folks are eligible for hospice for 6 months. So what we see is that people are not necessarily accessing their benefit for the full length of time that they could be. We would like to see people spending more time on hospice and getting the full benefit of the service. On the right-hand side, you can see some data on utilization by race. So you can see that hospice utilization among white patients was at, so of Medicare beneficiaries, 53.4% were on the hospice benefit when they died, compared to 38.7% of non-white patients, which is a utilization difference of about 14.7%. We have some work to do to really fully understand that difference. There's, you know, different things that could be contributing to that, different causes of death, cultural differences and preferences, differential access, and awareness of hospice and palliative care. So we are working to better understand that difference, but worth noting that there is a gap there. This chart is showing hospice utilization by county in Minnesota. So you can see kind of at the top end, we have some counties that have in this upwards of 60% of Medicare beneficiaries using their Medicare hospice benefit. And then on the bottom end, we do have counties that are below 30% and below 20%. This is showing sort of the same data, but as a graphic of our state. Again, this is from 2017. And you can see that the white counties and the light green counties represent lower hospice utilization. So our goal would be to see the state, you know, full of all that dark green if people were fully accessing and utilizing hospice. In Minnesota, these are the top five primary diagnoses for folks on hospice. So cancer is still the top diagnosis at 25%, but we're seeing many more diagnoses of dementia. So that represents 20% of folks on hospice, and that's a trend. At the national and state level, we expect to see more and more dementia diagnoses as the primary diagnoses. Stroke, congestive heart failure, and COPD round out the top five. So increasing access to high-quality end-of-life care really does require a multi-pronged approach. So one, we need to make sure that the current and future palliative care and hospice workforce is strong and that we have enough folks to provide this care. We also want to make sure that non-hospice and palliative care healthcare professionals are trained in the concepts and principles of palliative care, which includes advanced care planning. And we also want to make sure that patients, families, and consumers know about these services and know how to access them. So some specific suggestions for how we might increase hospice use in Minnesota. One, we can support the recommendations of the Minnesota Palliative Care Advisory Council. So the advisory council was established by the legislature in 2017. They put out an annual report and have a whole host of recommendations as to how we can increase access to palliative care. If we can get more people connected to palliative care upstream, you know, when they're diagnosed with a serious illness, we'll see more people move on to hospice when the time is right. We need to address our current and long-term workforce crisis. So just like our other long-term care partners, the pandemic has caused a real strain for hospice providers in terms of their workforce. We need both immediate and long-term solutions for that. We can support education and training for both primary and specialty palliative care and hospice. Primary palliative care is really, you know, getting folks trained in those core principles of pain and symptom management, the basics of advanced care planning. We can really improve quality of care by providing that training broadly across the healthcare sector. We can fund a public awareness campaign for palliative care and hospice that is culturally and linguistically appropriate. We can fund grief and bereavement services and utilize hospices as community resources. And we want to ensure that hospice providers can provide palliative care under their hospice license. So currently you need a home care license to provide a palliative care program, and we would be benefited to see hospice be able to provide palliative care more easily. And I'm happy to take questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for Ms. Hassauer? Representative Ackland.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple. So is palliative care, you mentioned it was a team effort. Several people were involved, in, including a physician. So is this in coordination with a person's private physician, or does this team take over the care and they become the private provider or the primary provider, I should say?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, absolutely. It is in coordination with your primary care doctor. So the team is a doctor, a nurse, a social worker, and a spiritual counselor, and they would work in conjunction with your other, whether it's your primary care or other specialists.
Representative Backlund.
Sorry. So the palliative care doctor is taking care of a specific symptom or pain or whatever, and your primary doctor goes ahead and takes care of all the other issues that you may be experiencing.
Ms. Hassauer.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes, that is correct.
Okay. Representative Backlund.
And so my second question was, you mentioned that hospice, one of the differences is palliative care has no end. Whereas hospice, you are expected to have a 6-month life expectancy. And just, you didn't mention this, but I know from taking care of a mother and a mother-in-law on hospice, that 6 months, you mentioned that part of the problem is people don't utilize the service enough. And I think people are afraid that they need to be within that 6 months, so they're waiting until they're sure that they're not going to extend. But hospice can be extended beyond the 6 months. In fact, my mother actually was on hospice for 1.5 years. So that, I don't like to see that as a barrier to people accessing the care, because if you think that's possible, even if it goes beyond, they don't move you out of the program. So.
Yep. Ms. Hassauer, I don't know if you had any comment or response.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that's correct. It is possible to stay on beyond the 6 months if it's appropriate and if you can be recertified.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Ackland. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Hassauer, for the good information today. I had a couple questions. One is, you mentioned the workforce, staffing of workforce, and I just wanted two questions on that. One, what does it require to become licensed as a hospice care provider? And what does the workforce look like in Minnesota? You showed a good map of where it's being utilized, but are there gaps because of the workforce now?
Ms. Hassauer.
So there's a whole licensure process that's managed through the Minnesota Department of Health. Many requirements regarding being prepared for infection control, for example, being able to provide that kind of care. And in terms of the workforce currently, we have significant gaps with home health aides. That it's very difficult to hire. We have nursing positions that are open. We have had programs, at least one program in Minnesota that was serving the Fergus Falls area has closed just due to these very significant staffing shortages. It's very much like our nursing homes and our assisted living facilities. We're seeing the same kinds of crunches. And even before the pandemic, we know that as our population ages in Minnesota, there's going to be increasing demand for, geriatricians, for hospice, for palliative care. And we see a lot of folks who started hospice in Minnesota, 40, 50 years ago now retiring. And so we have a lot of retirements on the horizon. So that's adding to the challenge in terms of maintaining our workforce as well.
Thank you. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Early in your presentation, Ms. Hassauer, you mentioned the reimbursement for palliative care. And I don't need a super detailed information, but I'm just wondering about, you said it's lacking. And I wonder just if that's based on certain conditions that aren't qualifying for palliative care, which maybe should be, or how is that reimbursement lacking? If you could just describe some of the issues there.
Ms. Hassauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Bierman. So palliative care, as I mentioned, does not have a Medicare benefit like hospice does. And so it's really up to the individual, for example, health insurance companies to say what they're going to cover. And what might happen is that they might cover, for example, a visit from the physician, but they don't necessarily cover a visit from the spiritual counselor or the social worker. We see a lot of variation in sort of what gets covered in terms of palliative care. So in hospice, the conditions of participation for Medicare require an interdisciplinary team that's really central to the provision of palliative care. And again, that includes a hospice, a nurse, a social worker, and a spiritual counselor. That's what we would want to see, if somebody is providing palliative care. And in order to really fully staff that team, you need to be able to provide reimbursement for all of those members of the team.
Thank you. Representative Bierman?
Yes, one more question, please. Just regarding the description of palliative care that you provided and needing a doctor to certify that the patient needs palliative care. I've met a few doctors recently who have told me that palliative care is only for people who have, it's not really a care that's provided for people that have chronic conditions as much as just for end of life. And so I know there's some not quite uniformity on doctors in that regard. And I'm sure it's getting better, but I just wondered if you could comment on that issue.
Ms. Hassauer.
Thank you for the question. So there definitely is some work that we need to do for folks to be able to clearly understand when you're appropriate for palliative care and when you're appropriate for hospice. Hospice is that end of life period. But we, certainly see that some people conflate the two and don't see serious, palliative care being appropriate early on. There's a lack of awareness, and that speaks to some of the work that we want to do around, public education and providing education to the full, healthcare sector to be able to say, actually you can make a referral for palliative care as soon as somebody is diagnosed with a serious illness. They can come in and help with some of those treatment decisions that you might have to make, or, some of the anxiety, stress that you would be feeling when you're diagnosed with a serious illness. They can come in, they can address the concerns, and then they can come in and out as appropriate. And it's, you're right, not everybody is aware that that is something that is an option on the table. The other piece of that is that because there's not the full reimbursement, we don't have as much access to palliative care, teams across the state as we have for hospice. So it may just not be available.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Hassauer.
Thank you. I don't see any additional member questions, so thank you, Ms. Hassauer. You're welcome to stick around if you like for the discussion of the bill. So I'll turn now to House File 2670. Just so members are aware, this bill is currently in the Commerce Committee. I thought it would be helpful for the committee just to have some discussion about end-of-life issues, and I think this bill is an important component of it. We're not a finance committee, and the insurance questions related to it will certainly, you know, would certainly need to be worked out in the Commerce Committee. I'll allow a little leeway if questions come up, but we probably don't want to get too far into the weeds on that aspect of the bill. So with that said, we can turn to the bill. Representative Morrison, would you like to describe your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, House File 2670 is a bill that provides coverage for advanced care planning services so that all Minnesotans have access to this important part of the life care continuum. Advanced care planning services, in its essence, is a discussion between a health professional and a patient to talk about the patient's healthcare wishes in the event the patient becomes unable to make decisions about their care. It includes a discussion of future healthcare decisions that may need to be made and how the patient can let others know about healthcare preferences and decisions, an explanation of healthcare directives and similar documents, and completion of a healthcare directive form if they choose. These conversations are critical so that patients are educated about end-of-life issues so they can make the most informed decision for themselves about their own healthcare. It's also a health equity issue, as has come up in the discussion this morning, as research shows that barriers to access to end-of-life care exist, certainly in BIPOC and LGBT communities. This is an informational hearing, of course, but I'm grateful for the opportunity to present the bill, and I'm sure we're all grateful to Dr. Moravec and Ms. Hassauer for their presentations to educate all of us about advanced care planning and other end-of-life issues and the benefits and importance of it. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take questions and continue the conversation if members have any.
Okay, members, any questions? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Representative Morrison, just as I read the bill here, we're going to mandate and obviously reimburse, so probably the discussion is going to include a CPT code so that medical professionals can upload the charge. Going way back on the school board, okay, I always was a little bit resistant to mandates like this. I don't have, you know, these are highly qualified professionals and intelligent. They see firsthand this situation, and I would be more comfortable with a recommendation or a suggestion versus a mandate with reimbursement. I mean, number one, it's going to increase healthcare costs and premiums ultimately. And again, I think it's a valid discussion to have, but I just am uncomfortable with a mandate like I was on teachers to a certain degree in the classroom, unless they weren't doing a good job. If there was a problem, of course we had to address it. But for the most part, I always said, leave the teacher alone. They know what they're doing. And here I say, leave the professional who deals with this end of life planning, make a recommendation or a suggestion, but a mandate with reimbursement, causes me to pause. Any feedback, Representative Morrison?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Grunhagen. You know, I think we've seen that when things aren't covered, only certain people have access to them. This encourages these conversations. And I can just tell you from personal experience, I'm sure there are many watching today or who are part of this committee who have had personal experiences with end-of-life issues in their own families. And these conversations have been so important. And it's been interesting to me in my own family to see kind of the variety of ideas and hopes that people have for what their end of life journey will look like. So it's a little bit different for every person, but there is tremendous comfort for both the individual and the family to know how the person feels about what their wishes are so that the best plans can be made to honor those. So this is a critically important conversation that all of us need to be having. And if there's not reimbursement for it, unfortunately, they're not going to happen in many cases.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, I still fall on the side of a recommendation. I don't know if we need to micromanage everything they do. This is an important area. But again, these are professionals, highly trained. They deal with this on a regular basis. They know the value of it. And to put a mandate on with reimbursement, when I got people crying over the price of their cost of their premiums, it just gives me pause. I know you mean well, Representative, but those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam, that was the last committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to thank Dr. Representative Morrison for bringing the bill forward. I think this is an issue that, as we heard from Dr. Morvick earlier, that there's not enough of this going on for people who need it when the time comes or when you're getting to that point where the time is nigh. And I think that that demonstrates the need for this bill and for these discussions that we're having in this committee today. And it's kind of a personal thing for me. I mean, I think we all go through this when we lose a parent or go through that journey of a hospice event. And my parents, they passed in very different ways, but what it taught me was to be prepared at the end so that, you know, you can have your family together with you and people are on the same page and that you get your wishes, your autonomy to make those choices ahead of time. And if you don't have these conversations, that's not necessarily going to be the result. So it makes it easier for families, children, everything. So I really appreciate you bringing the bill forward and I want to see it progress. And I think it will bring that beneficence that we're seeking, from, as Dr. Morvick described. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Any additional member questions or comments? Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrison, this is an informational hearing only. I don't think the committee is in possession of the bill. It has no Senate companion. What is the plan? It appears that it's, like you had suggested, a conversational, but beyond that, I'm just kind of wondering what your expectations are.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Heintzman. You are correct. This is an informational hearing. It is my hope that this is an ongoing conversation in the legislature. This is I hear from a lot of constituents about these issues. I don't know if you do, but there's a real hunger out there to advance these issues and have these conversations. So it's my hope that this will be an ongoing conversation in the legislature and in Minnesota.
Representative Heintzman.
I'll just thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to be clear, your expectation isn't for the bill to go anywhere necessarily. We're just talking about it is what I'm hearing.
Representative Morrison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, of course, it's my hope that the bill progresses, but we do have a deadline on Friday, and this is an informational hearing today.
Representative Heintzman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds like I'm on the right track. So I appreciate the bill author's honesty and candor about the future of the bill. Thank you.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Morrison, for bringing this bill forward. And I appreciate, you know, like many who have spoken already today, having lost my parents, it's This is an important conversation to start earlier, and I really appreciate the proactive nature of this bill. I think that too oftentimes we put things off until, unfortunately, it becomes a stressful time, and so then it's hard to make decisions and hard to honor decisions that you haven't talked about around, you know, important choices for patients. So I just, having been through this process, you know, losing a parent and, you know, going through hospice and palliative care both, and the services are important. The knowledge is important. As Representative Bierman said, having all of family on the same page is important. And the sooner we can start those questions, the better. I think that, I don't know, in my family, it's not something that we talk about a lot. And we need to understand that it's an important conversation for people's dignity and quality of life and all the things that are associated with it. I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. I appreciate you starting the conversation. And I'm hopeful we can continue to move this bill forward.
Thank you, Representative Akam. Any additional member questions or comments? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Morrison?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for a good conversation. And then I have a much gratitude to our presenters, Dr. Moravec and Mr. Haushauer, for their presentations. This is an important issue. I'm grateful that we've been able to elevate it today. And I hope that we can continue to make progress in the legislature so that all Minnesotans have access to this important care. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. So there's nothing further on our agenda. Thank you to the testifiers and to Representative Morrison for presenting the bill. Friday is the first committee deadline, so we do not have any more regular committee hearings scheduled, but members should certainly keep an eye on their emails. It's possible there will be some either informational or after deadline type hearings on bills. I do want to thank the committee members for their participation and staff for all of their work making these committee hearings happen. I'm not going to attempt to name everybody. When I do that, I invariably forget somebody. But I just know that I really appreciate the work of all the staff, nonpartisan, partisan on both sides, that goes into making these committee hearings happen. I don't have any additional agenda items. I do see Representative Grunhagen, you have your hand up.
Yeah, Mike, or Chair Freiberg, I'm sorry. You've been good to work with, good communication, and I, even though we differ on some issues, we've always done it respectfully, and you've allowed good discussion in this committee. So I just want to thank you for that, for myself and my members, and look forward to having a fruitful and effective balance of the session. Thank you. Yep.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. The feeling is mutual. You've been very communicative with me as well, and good to work with. As we have to do, we have to acknowledge we don't see eye to eye on every issue, but I do appreciate the good working relationship you've had. No other member hands raised. Once again, thank you, everybody. It's been a great committee to work with on all sides. So with that, this meeting is adjourned.